We'll start at the beginning of the Seder and try to cover as many of the topics that I have intended. I doubt if we'll cover all of them, some of them. Right, the Seder starts with the Parsha of Nedarim, that a person has the ability to make a neder and to prohibit something that really is mutter, but prohibit it on himself. Now, on the one hand, Chazal say that nedarim are not necessarily a positive thing. Lo daicha ma'isa astra Torah, it's not enough what the Torah said you can't do, you have to make more things. Right? And it says that whoever makes a neder is like he's building his own private mizbeah, making his own private religion. And it's better not to make nedarim, even if you're going to keep them. And that's on one side. On the other side, it says that nedarim are a positive thing. So, is it positive? Not positive. What's the idea? So it could be like this, that ideally a person should be able to keep what the Torah says, what's mutter, what's a mitzvah, what's aser. That's the ideal. And therefore, in an ideal state, making a neder is not a positive thing. However, where a person has trouble keeping what the Torah says, either he has trouble keeping mitzvahs because of various situations or conditions that exist that prevent him from keeping mitzvahs because of his yetzer hara or whatever, or he has a predilection to certain averas and it's hard for him to control himself. So in that situation, the situation is less than ideal. There's an idea to make a neder, which will either bolster a mitzvah by giving you some other personal incentive, or to keep you far away from an avera by giving you the personal incentive to stay away from the things that may lead you to that avera. Okay. So, again, ideally speaking, there's no inyan to add new things. But where the ideal is not going to be kept anyway, so better you should... Tosus compares it to the following. It says that a person... What's it called? They shouldn't fast on Shabbos. But if you have a dream, that really bad dream, and you're going to be worried about it the whole Shabbos, better you should fast, and then fast to make up for it. Fast on Sunday, so then if it's bad to fast, then you shouldn't fast on Shabbos. Not fast on Shabbos and make up for it afterwards, but the idea is really, ideally, it'd be better not to fast on Shabbos. But if by not fasting on Shabbos, you're going to be worried about this bad dream and ruin your Shabbos anyway, so then it's better to fast on Shabbos, which is not ideal, but the situation isn't ideal, and to make up for it, compensate for it afterwards. Same thing idea over here. That ideally, nedarim are not necessarily a positive thing. You don't have to add on to the Torah. But if the situation is less than ideal, which most of the time it is, and a person knows the neder for him will be a positive thing in being able to keep the Torah, because if he doesn't make the neder, he's going to have a hard time keeping the Torah properly. The neder will give him an extra incentive to do things right, then the neder is okay. That's the basic idea of nedarim.
Well, usually examples of nedarim aren't people trying to bolster their mitzvah. Usually, I won't eat by your house. It's usually not the neder. Usually,
yeah, those kind of nedarim, it's better not to make. Right, the nedarim that are okay to make are things that are a siyag. Nedarim is siyag leprishus. Right, you want to separate yourself from something. You know you have a hard time doing it. You know if you make a nether, you'll have a personal incentive. That kind of nether can be okay. Another kind of nether that's okay. No dream, but be'esh tzara. Person has a tzara. So he wants to make a nether. I'll do this. I'll give this when I have the opportunity to. There's a different idea. There, the word tzara means narrow. Tzar. Person feels narrow. Feels hemmed in. So part of the way that he feels that he can get out of that narrow situation is by expanding his horizon. So you make a nether, you expand yourself. There, the expansion could be a positive thing because of the negative situation. So there, you're allowed to make a nether that right now I can't do. Right, but if I'll get to a situation where I won't be so tzikvetch, so narrowed in, I'll be able to do it, that's fine. Now, in the parsha of Nedarim, we see two things. One is we see the power of speech, that a person with his speech can create new prohibitions. And the prohibition becomes a Torah prohibition, because the Torah gave power to what I say. So that's one thing we see from the parsha of Neder. We also see that even though speech has a tremendous power, but you can break that power. How? By having charata, by regretting. If you regret making the neder from the very beginning, that's how Hataras Nedarim works. Right? You go to a Talmud Chacham, and he finds a Pesach. He says, if you would have known this, would you have made that neder to begin with? He says, no. If I would have known that this and this would have happened, I never would have made the neder. You regret it from the beginning. Then he can be matter the neder. And the nether, the heter of the nether, is retroactive. It's like the nether was never there. So how does it work? So the Mesillas Yesharim says that, we'll get to another part, but it works basically that regret is a mental erasure of what happened. When you regret something, you say basically saying that if I would have thought about what I was doing, I would never have done it. So I mentally would like to erase it. So what you do mentally helps and has a power and erases the neder. The mental desire to erase it. That gives the power to the chacham to permit the neder. Therefore, is it no wonder that on Yom Kippur, the minig is to start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidri. We speak about all the nedarim that we made, and we regret them, and we want them to be null and void. Why? Because what is the whole Yom Kippur? The whole Yom Kippur is devoted to tshuva. The main part of tshuva is confessing your sin and confessing that you regret doing it and you'll never do it again. Okay? Now, a person may feel, I sinned. What's it going to help for me to say a bunch of words? Right? What can words accomplish? And a person may feel that Yom Kippur is a waste of time. What am I accomplishing? So we start Yom Kippur by speaking about Nedarim. Nedarim tell me that speech has a tremendous power, both to do things, make things, and to break them also. And if you regret, then you can erase what you created. So then that's tshuva too. You can do things, sins, and if you regret them, you can erase them. So the whole idea of Kol Nidre is a very fine preface to Yom Kippur to tell me that regret can erase very powerful things. It can erase sins also. Okay. That's the... Then something we spoke about in the past, but I'll mention it again since this is the Sedra. The Torah says the following, gives the following scenario. A woman makes a nether. Okay, she makes a nether, I'm not going to eat chocolate cake. Okay, no more cake, I'm not eating cake. She wants to go on a diet, she doesn't want to eat cake. She makes a nether to help bolster her self-control. Now her husband, for the duration of the day that he hears of her nether, has the ability to eradicate that nether, to be made for the nether. And the husband heard the nether, and he doesn't want his wife to go on a diet. Right? I don't know, but the more of her, the better. He likes he likes his wife. And And therefore, he's made for the nether. He says that nether is destroyed, gone. He doesn't have to tell her. Okay, he forgets to tell her that it was made for the nether. She holds out for 2 weeks, thinking she has this nether. And at the end of 2 weeks, she gives in and she swallows a whole chocolate cake. She feels terrible, right? Both physically and spiritually. Okay? I made this nether and now I transgressed my nether. She goes to her husband, she says, I did something terrible today. 2 weeks ago I made a nether, I'm not going to eat cake. Today I swallowed a whole chocolate cake. The husband says, don't worry about it. When I heard the nether, I was made for it. You never really had a nether. It was gone. So, you think that you did something wrong, but you really didn't do anything wrong. So Torah says, Isha Haferam, even though her husband nullified the nether, Vashem Yislachla, God has to forgive her. She has to do tshuva. Rabbi Akiva said, learn from this, Niskaven lechol boser chazir. If a person intended to eat chazir, but by mistake he ate kosher. Okay? The example I always like to give, you walk into a restaurant in New York, I used to say Tel Aviv, but let's keep it out of there. So you walk into a restaurant in New York, and you want to, you say, I'm tired of eating kosher, it has no taste, you know, I want to taste a non-kosher steak, something that really tastes good. You walk into this restaurant, you order a non-kosher steak. You don't know that the night before, the restaurant kitchen burnt down. And they can't produce anything. But they didn't want to close up because they'd lose customers. So they made a deal with the Glatt Kosher restaurant down the block that if anybody comes in and orders anything, they would supply the food through the back door. And they would serve it as if it's theirs. So the waiter goes into the kitchen, gets on the phone, calls the Glatt Kosher restaurant. He says, there's a guy here who wants a steak. Send me over a steak. Oh, he sends over a steak. They bring it on disposable plates and with disposable silverware, and he apologizes. We had a problem in our kitchen, but here's your steak. The guy's sitting there digging into this steak. He says, nah, now this is a steak. Not like the guy down the block, the Glatt Kosher plate. This tastes like a steak. And he's eating the steak, thinking it's a trefa steak, and it's a kosher steak, Glatt Kosher. When he finds out that the steak was Glatt Kosher, he still has to do tshuva. Because if you intended to eat treif, but by accident you ate kosher, you still have to do tshuva. Okay. Now we learn from this parasha. Now that seems on the surface to contradict a klal that machshava ra'a ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzar fo l'maisa. You don't get punished for bad intentions. You get punished for bad actions. But just because you intended to do something wrong and you didn't do it, right, you don't get punished. Example, different case. You walk into the trefa restaurant and they have a kitchen and they could serve you a trefa steak and you order a trefa steak and the waiter is bringing it to your table and he gets about 10 feet away from your table and a lightning bolt strikes him. The steak is now ashes, so is the waiter, so is the whole restaurant except for your table. And you're sitting there watching everything around you smolder and you go home hungry. Okay? You would have eaten that steak had they served it. But by conditions beyond your control, circumstances beyond your control, you didn't eat the steak. You don't have to do tshuva. You don't have to, you don't get punished for ordering the steak. That's called machshava ra'a. You had a bad intention. But ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzar fo l'maisa. God does not consider it as if you did it. And what's the difference between these two cases? In both cases, you only had bad intentions.
But there was a
maisa. But the maisa was eating kosher steak. What difference does it make? So what are we left with? Only a bad intention. The answer is that you don't know one bit of information that makes the answer very simple. The Gemara says that that rule, that you don't get punished for bad intentions, is limited. It's limited if you haven't done the sin twice already. But if you've already done the sin twice, for instance, you walked into the trefa restaurant on Sunday, ordered a trefa steak, they served it, you ate it. Monday you went in and said, give me another one. They served it, you ate it. Tuesday you walked in, ordered a steak, and then the lightning bolt struck. On Tuesday you'll get punished as if you ate that steak, even though it was circumstances beyond your control. Why? Because the Gemara says that once you've done the sin twice, then it becomes like heter to you and you definitely would have done it. There's no reason to assume you wouldn't. So what does that mean? Why doesn't God punish people for bad intentions? Because he gives them the benefit of the doubt that they wouldn't have carried it through. In other words, had the lightning bolt not struck the waiter, okay, in the first scenario, you probably would have changed your mind. Now, even though God knows everything, but when it comes to our free choice, he acts as if he doesn't know. However that works. Okay, so don't get bogged down with what God knows. God functions with us as if he doesn't know. Okay? So therefore God can give us the benefit of the doubt. And he can say that I know, or I at least give you the benefit of the doubt, that had the lightning bolt not struck, and they served you the steak, at the last minute you would have changed your mind. But if you've already done the sin twice, there's no reason to assume that you wouldn't have done it a third time. Once you got in the habit of doing it twice, we assume that it's considered like it's okay for you. you consider it okay. And therefore, there's no more benefit of the doubt. Therefore, when you ate what you thought was a treif of steak, there's no benefit of the doubt. When we give you a benefit of the doubt, that you would have not done it, you did it. You thought it was treif and you ate it. There's no more benefit of the doubt. Right? But in the case where you didn't actually do it, then we can give you the benefit of the doubt. You would have changed your mind up until two times that you did the Aveira, third time now. So that is the parameters of here. Where God can't give you the benefit of the doubt, you get punished even for bad choices. Where he can give you the benefit of the doubt, you don't get punished for the bad choice, only for the action. Okay, let's go on to something else. What? Because by the third time, it's not only mutter, it's a mitzvah. If you've done something wrong once, you still know it's wrong. Twice, it's already mutter. Three times, a mitzvah. The reason is that there's a machlokas, a tanoim, Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachomim. How many times is a chazaka? We know that a chazaka is three times. But Rabbi Yehuda holds a chazaka is two times. If you've done something, you repeated it two times. When it comes to Aveiras, since the Yetzer Hara is helping along, even after two times already, it's a chazaka. Okay, next. It says the Rabban Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu to take Nekama and Midian, to revenge, the Jewish people's revenge, the God's revenge against the Midianim, because they made us sin. Okay, two things. First of all, we see from here how serious it is to make a person sin. Because the Egyptians didn't make us sin, but they tortured us, they killed our kids, they did terrible things to us. Yet we have a mitzvah, lo sasayiv mitzri, not to abominate an Egyptian. We're not to have feelings of hatred against the Mitzrim, because we were in their land, they were a host to us, not such a great host for most of the time, but we did benefit from them, don't abhor them. But Midian is basically our cousins? Not cousins, some relation, through Lot, right? Midian. Midian. Right? Midian, at least Moshe Rabbeinu married his wife from Midian.
Yes,
right? Right, Yisro is the right guy. Midian, we have to, start up with them and make war against them and have an enmity with them. Why? So Chazal learned from here, Godol hamachtio yosem min ahargo. Somebody who makes you sin is worse than somebody who kills you. Somebody who kills somebody, kills them in this world. He doesn't affect necessarily their share of the world to come. Somebody who makes you sin, gets you in this world and the next world. Takes away your eternity. That's why the halacha is that apikursim, people who are heretics, in the time when the world was the way it should be, okay, in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, or even the first Beis Hamikdash, whatever, there was a mitzvah to kill heretics. Right? Moridim v'lo ma'ilim. You may not be able to kill them openly, but if you could get away with it and cause their death, indirectly, was a mitzvah. For instance, you see a heretic fall into a well, and there's a ladder in the well to get out. And you come by and you say, "Ooh, my kid's kite is caught in the tree. I need the ladder. But don't worry, I'll be back within 2 weeks." Right? So obviously, the guy's not going to be around in 2 weeks. Right? He's going to drown within the next few hours without the ladder. But, you know, I didn't realize the guy was drowning. I thought he was bathing. Whatever, what's it called? Right? So you can get away with it, kill him. Bisman Hazeh, that doesn't apply. We don't kill heretics today. Says what?
There's two variations in the book of Manashin that they changed over from Baal Kariya too.
Right, could be. Okay. Could be that one is right. We'll see 1 second. But the Manashin was not 100%, because there you're just davening. You let the Rabbanim Shem take care of it. Here you physically are killing somebody. The Chazon Ish says it doesn't apply today. Why? Because when did it apply? When people saw that if you sin, there are what's it called, terrible repercussions. There was a correlation between sinning and tragedy and mitzvahs and prosperity. That doesn't exist in our time of Hester Ponim. We don't see that correlation. But there was a time in the world when you could see the correlation. You could see that if the Jewish people sinned, they knew there was going to be a drought. There wouldn't be rain. And if they did mitzvahs, they knew there would be rain. The chukosai telechu. Okay? There was a period in history where that was the case. And therefore, let me give you the following scenario. Okay? How would you look at it? Okay? There's a person on the top of a building, a sniper, indiscriminately shooting bullets and killing innocent people, men, women, and children, below. And you've tried everything to try to get him off of that roof, right, to disarm him, to convince him to stop doing it. Nothing helps. Nothing helps. There's no way of getting him down except to get another sniper to kill him. Now, if somebody killed that person, how would you view the person who killed this sniper? Right, as a murderer or a hero?
Hero.
Obviously a hero. He saved innocent life. This guy is spraying bullets around killing people. If we really understood what it is, a person who spews heresy is damaging the world. In addition, first of all, he has a direct influence over people that makes people, you know, follow his ways, read his books, hear his ideas, and makes them, what's it called, give up their share in the world to come by becoming heretics like him. One possibility. In addition, even if he doesn't convince anybody, but just the heresy in the world is like pollution, right? Give another example. Today, this is an extreme, absurd example, but it's an example, right? People say, you know, live and let live. What does the difference to make? As long as you're not harming anybody, you know, let him have his ideas and you have your ideas, and just, you know, don't be influenced by him. Would you say the same thing in the following case, right? Today, there's a definitely strong evidence that fluorocarbons, right, weaken the ozone layer and permit radiation to come into the atmosphere and causes cancer, whatever, right? Let's say it would be an absurd, scenario that you spray your deodorant here and the fluorocarbons go up, and 10,000 miles away in China, it opens a window in the ozone layer, and 10,000 Chinese are struck with cancer on the spot. Right? Death sentence for 10,000 Chinese because you spritzed your underarm with this deodorant. Okay, let's say that would be the case. Could anybody make a case and say, look, I'm doing this in the privacy of my own bedroom. It's my underarm. It's my deodorant. Right? Don't tell me what to do. No. If you spritz that thing, you are killing 10,000 Chinese in the other end of the world. You have polluted the world in a case in a way that is dangerous to other people. So it's not your privacy of your thing. It's not live and let live. What you're doing is harmful to 10,000 people. It'll even be harmful to one person. You won't have the right to do that. So if we can understand physical pollution in that way, spiritual pollution is even worse. Somebody who sins, right, in an intensive way creates pollution in the world that who knows what kind of tragedies it causes, what kind of damage it causes. So a person can't say, look, I'm doing this in the privacy of my own home, mind your own business, and it has nothing to do with you. No, it has to do with me. Because what you do affects the entire world. That's the case. So stopping such a person also would be a mitzvah. And if the only way you could stop him and save 10,000 Chinese is to kill the guy, you got to kill him too. So, if we understood that somebody who is spewing heresy is no less than the guy, what's it called, spewing bullets, except there he's only killing people in this world. This guy's killing people eternally. And the pollution that he's causing causes who knows what kind of horrendous repercussions. So, I would understand, if you kill this guy, you're doing a mitzvah. You're a hero. You're not a murderer. But we live in a world where we may believe that. Okay, you could all believe what I just said. But do we feel it? It's a different story. Right? How would you react to the following true story? Remember, in the 1960s it happened. That's when the Balei Tshuva were not so popular. right? So there was a kid who grew up in a conservative temple, and he became frum. And he became a little overzealous. So he was upset that all those years his conservative rabbi had been misleading him and deprived him of knowing the truth of what he learned, what Torah was. So he did what any, you know, red-blooded Baal Tshuva would do. He showed up into the conservative temple on Shabbos and shot the rabbi, right, during his drasha, dead.
Was there a neighbor?
Shot the rabbi dead. Okay. I don't know, before the drasha, after the drasha, the middle of the drasha, whatever. Before the drasha, probably to get sympathy from the other people. In any case, how would we look at it? I look at it, right? The guy's a nut, right? Obviously a deranged person. My first thought isn't, hey, what's it called? He's a hero. He killed this heretic who was spewing whatever. We're not on that level. We don't see the relationship. If we see bullets killing people, we know this guy's a sniper and a terrorist. We see pollution causing who knows what kind of horrendous results. We can understand the people who spew that pollution are criminals. But to believe that a person who is doing something wrong spiritually is such a danger, I believe it, but I don't feel it. And therefore my first knee-jerk reaction to that is, the guy's deranged. The guy who killed him is a nut. Right?
Well, just replace him with another guy.
What?
Just replace the rabbi with someone else.
Yeah, whatever. But one less Rosh of the world. Okay. Right? If the rabbi was a Rosh, I don't know, maybe the rabbi was a Tzaddik Shadish, I have no idea. Right? Let's say the rabbi was a real Rosh. Right? He knew better and he was intending to mislead people or whatever. Right? Still, you heard somebody killed him. You would not relate to it as if you related to killing the sniper. It's a different story. Here, it's real. Here, it's not real. I believe it, but it's not the world of reality. Yeah?
I think I recall it. Doesn't the Rambam say, like, you know, basically, if he's sitting by the well, you are permitted to, like, push him?
Could be. That, I don't know. It's a way that you can do it indirectly.
Indirectly. But still, but he possibly says long after all this, that this is the
Rambam. No. The Maisa Bizman Hazeh, the Chazonish says that, okay. Even though the Shulchan Aruch had mentioned it, the Maisa, he says, since the time of Beit HaMikdash, it's not something you do. Because the result then, it was to make a Kiddush Hashem. And now the result would be the opposite. All it would be is a Chilul Hashem. No one would understand. No one. And the few people who may understand, for them, they don't need it. So that is the idea. So therefore, that's why the idea of Gadol HaMachdiyo Yosem in a Hargum. Right? We have to be more militant against the Midyanim than against the Mitzrim. Okay. What's the idea though of taking revenge? Why is it important to take revenge? Revenge, l'chori, not allowed to take revenge. Right? Losikom velosito. So Torah says you can't take revenge for things that are not important. Somebody didn't loan you his lawnmower, you're not going to loan you your lawnmower because of that. That's nourishment. But revenge on something that is serious, right? Somebody did something that gave the impression that evil succeeds and that evil gains. So it gives the impression to people that if you do things wrong, you gain, right? If there's a positive result from doing evil things. It has a terrible effect on the world. Revenge, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, is like balancing the books. There was a thrust in a negative way that evil prospered. If you can take revenge and take away that, then you're balancing the books. You're giving a feeling in the world that evil doesn't pay, that it got its just reward. And people don't feel anymore that maybe it's worth doing evil, or people who do evil don't get punished. Now you see they do get punished. So revenge, when it's for something of importance, is not only not prohibited, it's a mitzvah. But that, the Rabbanu Shalom has to, what's it called? Nakamtos nikmosom and Chanukah. That was part of the what's it called? That the Rabbanu Shalom took our revenge. And here it says, Nekom nikmas b'nei Yisrael. There's revenge for the Jewish people. They made us sin, and now they have to suffer for it. Because if they don't, then people see that evil pays off. It's worth it.
Revenge and punishment are the same thing.
The what?
The whole semantic thing.
Punishment is also a term of revenge. Nakum yinakim is a way that the Torah describes punishment. But it's not always punishment. Sometimes it's much more general, where the result is that people get the feeling that things have been amended for. In other words, what I felt is a imbalance in the side of evil now has been balanced out, and that's a very positive thing in the world.
The Egyptians washing up on the shore of the mountain.
The what?
Like the Egyptians washing the shore by the feet.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, next different Indian, and I think we'll finish with this. This could be a topic to itself, but I just want to mention the idea. It says Elef Lamata, Elef Lamata. So there's a medrash that says that they didn't take 1,000 people to go out to battle from each tribe. They took 2,000 people. 1,000 went into battle, and 1,000 davened and learned Torah to give the merit to the 1,000 who were fighting physically that they should be successful. And that's how a Jewish army has to function. There are two fronts. There's the physical front, and there's a spiritual front. And the people who are learning Torah throughout the generations, right, the Kohanim, Leviim, right, Lomdei Torah, didn't go into the physical army, right? The Kohanim, Leviim did not go into the battle, but they were the ones who basically learned and davened that the others should be successful. Okay, and either one, without either one, you can't win without a physical army, and you can't win without a spiritual army. Right, if we only relied on our physical prowess, we would have disappeared long ago. So we have a spiritual power, but you also ain't somchim al hanes. You have to go into physical battle too. So I think for frum people, that's an understandable thing, that people who are sitting and learning Torah are no less defending this country than the people who are serving in the army. Right, both are doing a necessary thing. In fact, in Matityahu, we say a Mishaberach for the Chayalim, for Tzahal, by Kriyas HaTorah, but we add a few words in my edition. We say, Yivorech es Tzva Hagona Yisrael, right? V'yas kol eilu shalomdim bakol yeshivas hakdoshes vakolim shalomdim amishmar tzartzim. The people should hear that it's not only the physical soldiers that are defending the country, it's also people who are involved in the spiritual, and a person's learning Torah has to feel that. During the Six-Day War, and I know again it was reiterated during the Gulf War, Chaim Shmulevitz, during the Six-Day War, told the Bachram in Mir, he said, you know, we always say that you people who are learning Torah are the spiritual army, who give the spiritual power to the physical army. The people who are in the physical army don't take rest, b'nasdorim. They don't take walks, go to the pizza shop, you know, whatever. They're fighting till they fall off their feet, catch a few moments rest, and then back onto the front. If you are the spiritual army, then you have to function the same way. There's no time for naps. There's no time to go to a pizza shop. To sit and learn until you fall off your feet, and then, what's it called, come right back to the front. If you don't consider yourself like you're on the front, then you don't belong here. And during the Gulf War, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir told the Talmidim, he said, there are people here who now would like to go, you know, they came from America, and they want to go back because, you know, it's a time of war, and it's dangerous, you know. He said, we consider ourselves the spiritual army that works in conjunction with the physical army. Do you ever hear of a physical army that leaves in a time of battle? Right? Because it's safer. If you're spiritual soldiers, then you have just as much responsibility as the physical soldiers. And anybody who leaves during this time, don't bother coming back. You have no place here. That's what we told them. So, a person who's learning has to feel that. The only problem is that I once gave this shiur to a bunch of mothers, both of people who are learning and people who are in the army. And one mother said, Rabbi, that's very nice, but why should my son be in the front where his life is in danger, and your son is sitting in a base medrash, you know, pretty, what's it called, safe? So I said, I hear the question, but let me ask you a different question. Do you know that that not everybody is on the front. There are people in the physical army that are deep down in bunkers who are involved in the communications of the army. Okay, their lives are pretty much safer than your son who's on the front. There are also people in the kitchen peeling potatoes. They're not on the front either. They're preparing the meals for your son who's fighting on the front, but he has to eat. Okay. Should we say that in fairness, we're going to take everybody out of the kitchen, everybody out of the communication bunkers, and we're going to put everybody on the front? Obviously, we wouldn't win the war. Right? Everybody's life would be in danger. Okay. So we need people functioning in the physical army also. Some people are more readily in danger, but if we lose, everybody's in danger. Everybody's doing their part. So irrelevant to how much right now somebody's life is in danger, if they're needed in their part, and nobody else is going to do that part, they have to do it, right? Because your son wouldn't choose to be sitting in the yeshiva and learning Torah, so he chose to be, so fine. So everybody's doing their part, that makes everybody safer. But you can't go on where the imminent danger is, because if you go with that, it becomes absurd. Then nobody can be in anything except be on the front, and you can have an army like that.
But it's not really the recipe of the Torah. The Torah came, says, all of Shevet Reuven, again, and say, okay, you have to sit down and learn and do this. Everybody who was of the age went on to the army.
That's not the case. Not the case. When it says Chosen Mechupaso or Leviim, they didn't go to fight. They went to give support from the side for what's it called? They gave water, whatever, or spiritual support, but they didn't go amamish into battle. It's this idea: you can't, you're conscripted, but what your function is not the same for everybody. Some people don't go into actual physical battle. Can't be like that. Some people are not fit to go into physical battle. Right? If everybody just picks up a gun and walks into the army is bottle mavutl, the army doesn't want, you know, it has to have trained soldiers. Right? Not everybody can be a trained soldier, right? So just from the logistics, it can't work like that. So there have to be different functions. So we just believe, I said, look, if somebody's a chiloni, I said, I can't expect you to understand that somebody sitting in the yeshiva is giving what's it called defending the country. I can't expect, but at least you can understand where I'm coming from. If I do believe that, right, then that is a legitimate, just as legitimate as somebody peeling potatoes in the kitchen or sitting in a bunker and being involved with communications. Right? You may not accept that somebody sitting in yeshiva is equal to that, right? But if at least know where I come from. At least know where I'm coming from. I'm not coming from somebody who says, we don't need your army. Right? We do need your army. It's our army. But we need a lot of different functions to make all of everybody successful. That's the idea. Yeah.
I read the Military Magazine recently that to every one Krav, every one fighter, between 10 and 12 support troops fulfilling the various functions in which
10 to 12
per fighter to sustain one fighter on the front lines.
It makes sense. If you think about it, what you need to supply an army, right? Right? If everybody would be on the front, there couldn't be any army.
At the risk of being, I guess, antagonistic, the second Gulf War came out, Bein HaZmanim. How many weapons did Russia were filled with soldiers?
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm saying. Chaim Shmulevitz, you don't have to be antagonistic. But the truth is that many yeshivas cut off Bein HaZmanim and sent people back to learn. They did. They cut short Bein HaZmanim and they said you have to go back to learn. They did that.
And
but I'm telling you what Chaim Shmulevitz said.
Soldiers would rather be in the basement.
Yes and no. Yes
many
and no. It could be. Again, there's an exception. But I know many Balabatim in Matityahu who never went to yeshiva. So we used to have a program when we were in Moshav Shitufi. We sent guys to learn for a month. You know, because we could do that. You know, all the Moshav Parnosa was from what we were involved in, our Kerem or whatever. And we didn't make money anyway, so we didn't make if the guy worked, it didn't work. So, you know, we made like the same amount one way or the other. So we sent guys to learn for a month. Right? You went? Yeah, you went. What's it called? Yeah. So, sent people to work.
It was like back in America in 1967, I was in high school, and my yeshiva was not the CLE yeshiva, it was Borges, it was Yekis, and they told us girls we have to We must make sure that Eretz Yisrael survives. And we actually went in the evening and we said to him,
yeah. I'll tell you even more than that. Do you know that the Satmar Rebbe told his entire kehillah that they have to say tillim for the soldiers? In right, he said, you know, one thing what we do, you know, in peacetime or whatever. Here, the people's lives are on the line. Today, I don't know if they would do, but the Satmar Rebbe said that, what's it called? That say tillim for the soldiers. They should be successful. But in any case, so we sent people to learn for a month. Most of these people came back and they said, I can't do it. I'd rather be working in the Kerem. It's easier to work 10, 15 hours a day physically than to sit in the base medrash and my mind, I just can't take it. Right? So I don't know if everybody who is doing something physical would opt to be in a and be functional in the base medrash. A lot of people would be very happy to be in a base medrash and not learn, right? Just to be free. But to learn a base medrash is a different story.